Chapter 10. Reality. I can understand the mason who is always liable to fall off a scaffold in his working jacket, and to be carried to the hospital, having an infinite admiration of the radiant personage in spangles who goes into the clouds upon a bull, or upside down, and who, he takes it for granted not reflecting upon the thing, has, by uncommon skill and dexterity, conquered such mischances as those to which he and his acquaintance are continually exposed. I wish the morgue in Paris would not come here as I lie awake, with its ghastly beds, and the swollen saturated clothes hanging up, and the water dripping, dripping all day long, upon that other swollen saturated something in the corner, like a heap of crushed overripe figs, that I have seen in Italy. And this detestable morgue comes back again at the head of a procession of forgotten ghost stories. This will never do. I must think of something else as I lie awake, or, like that sagacious animal in the United States who recognized the colonel who was such a dead shot, I am a gone coon. What shall I think of? The late brutal assaults. Very good subject. The late brutal assaults. So whether, supposing I should see, here before me as I lie awake, the awful phantom described in one of those ghost stories, who, with a headdress of shroud, was always seen looking in through a certain glass door at a certain dead hour, whether, in such a case it would be the least consolation to me to know on philosophical grounds, that it was merely my imagination, is a question I can't help asking myself by the way. The late brutal assaults. I strongly question the expediency of advocating the revival of whipping for those crimes. It is a natural and generous impulse to be indignant at the perpetration of inconceivable brutality, but I doubt the whipping panacea gravely. Not in the least regard or pity for the criminal, whom I hold in far lower estimation than a mad wolf, but in consideration for the general tone and feeling, which is very much improved since the whipping times. It is bad for a people to be familiarized with such punishments. When the whip went out of Bridewell, and ceased to be flourished at the cart's tail, and at the whipping post, it began to fade out of madhouses, and workhouses, and schools and families, and to give place to a better system everywhere than cruel driving. It would be hasty, because a few brutes may be inadequately punished, to revive, in any aspect, what, in so many aspects, society is hardly yet happily rid of. The whip is a very contagious kind of thing, and difficult to confine within one set of bounds. Utterly abolish punishment by fine a barbarous device, quite as much out of date as wager by battle, but particularly connected in the vulgar mind with this class of offense, at least quadruple the term of imprisonment for aggravated assaults, and above all let us, in such cases, have no pet prisoning, vain glorifying, strong soup, and roasted meats, but hard work, and one unchanging, and uncompromising dietary of bread and water, well or ill, and we shall do much better than, by going down into the dark, to grope for the whip among the rusty fragments of the rack, and the branding iron, and the chains and gibbet from the public roads, and the weights that press men to death in the cells of Newgate. I had proceeded thus far, when I found I had been lying awake so long, that the very dead began to wake too, and to crowd into my thoughts most sorrowfully. Therefore, I resolved to lie awake no more, but to get up, and go out for a night walk, which resolution was an acceptable relief to me, as I dare say it may prove now to a great many more. The ghost of art. I am a bachelor, residing in rather a dreary set of chambers in the temple. They are situated in a square court of high houses, which would be a complete well, but for the want of water, and the absence of a bucket. I live at the top of the house, among the tiles and sparrows. Like the little man in the nursery story, I live by myself, and all the bread and cheese I get, which is not much, I put upon a shelf. I need scarcely add, perhaps, that I am in love, and that the father of my charming Julia objects to our union. I mention these little particulars as I might deliver a letter of introduction. The reader is now acquainted with me, and perhaps will condescend to listen to my narrative. I am naturally of a dreamy turn of mind, and my abundant leisure for I am called to the bar coupled with much lonely listening to the twittering of sparrows, and the pattering of rain, has encouraged that disposition. In my top set I hear the wind howl on a winter night, when the man on the ground floor believes it is perfectly still weather. The dim lamps with which our honorable society supposed to be as yet unconscious of the new discovery called gas, make the horrors of the staircase visible, deepen the gloom which generally settles on my soul when I go home at night. I am in the law, but not of it. I can't exactly make out what it means. I sit in Westminster Hall sometimes in character from 10 to 4. And when I go out of court, I don't know whether I am standing on my wig or my boots. It appears to me I mention this in confidence, as if there were too much talk and too much law, as if some grains of truth were started overboard into a tempestuous sea of chaff. All this may make me mystical. Still, I am confident that what I am going to describe myself as having seen and heard, I actually did see and hear. It is necessary that I should observe that I have a great delight in pictures. I am no painter myself, but I have studied pictures and written about them. I have seen all the most famous pictures in the world. My education and reading have been sufficiently general to possess me beforehand with a knowledge of most of the subjects to which a painter is likely to have recourse. And, although I might be in some doubt as to the rightful fashion of the scabbard of King Lear's sword, for instance, I think I should know King Lear tolerably well if I happened to meet with him. I go to all the modern exhibitions every season, and of course I revere the Royal Academy. I stand by its 40 academical articles almost as firmly as I stand by the 39 articles of the Church of England. I am convinced that in neither case could there be, by any rightful possibility, one article more or less. It is now exactly 3 years ago, this very month, since I went from Westminster to the Temple, one Thursday afternoon, in a cheap steamboat. The sky was black when I imprudently walked on board. It began to thunder and lighten immediately afterwards, and the rain poured down in torrents. The deck seeming to smoke with the wet, I went below, but so many passengers were there, smoking too, that I came up again, and buttoning my pea coat, and standing in the shadow of the paddle box, stood as upright as I could, and made the best of it. It was at this moment that I first beheld the terrible being, who is the subject of my present recollections. Standing against the funnel, apparently with the intention of drying himself by the heat as fast as he got wet, was a shabby man in threadbare black, and with his hands in his pockets, who fascinated me from the memorable instant when I caught his eye. Where had I caught that eye before? Who was he? Why did I connect him, all at once, with the Vicar of Wakefield, Alfred the Great, Gil Blas, Charles II, Joseph and his brethren, the Fairy Queen, Tom Jones, the Decameron of Boccaccio, Tam O'Shanter, the marriage of the Doge of Venice with the Adriatic, and the Great Plague of London? Why, when he bent one leg, and placed one hand upon the back of the seat near him, did my mind associate him wildly with the words, Number 142, Portrait of a Gentleman? Could it be that I was going mad? I looked at him again, and now I could have taken my affidavit that he belonged to the Vicar of Wakefield's family. Whether he was the Vicar, or Moses, or Mr. Burkhill, or the Squire, or a conglomeration of all four, I knew not, but I was impelled to seize him by the throat, and charge him with being, in some fell way, connected with the Primrose blood. He looked up at the rain, and then, oh heaven, he became St. John. He folded his arms, resigning himself to the weather, and I was frantically inclined to address him as the spectator, and firmly demand to know what he had done with Sir Roger de Coverley. The frightful suspicion that I was becoming deranged returned upon me with redoubled force. Meantime, this awful stranger, inexplicably linked to my distress, stood drying himself at the funnel, and ever, as the steam rose from his clothes, diffusing a mist around him, I saw through the ghostly medium all the people I have mentioned, and a score more, sacred and profane. I am conscious of a dreadful inclination that stole upon me, as it thundered and lightened, to grapple with this man, or demon, and plunge him over the side. But, I constrained myself I know not how to speak to him, and in a pause of the storm, I crossed the deck, and said, "What are you?" " he replied, hoarsely, "a model." "A what? " said one. "A model," he replied. "I sets to the profession for a bob a hour." All through this narrative I give his own words, which are indelibly imprinted on my memory. The relief which this disclosure gave me, the exquisite delight of the restoration of my confidence in my own sanity, I cannot describe. I should have fallen on his neck, but for the consciousness of being observed by the man at the wheel. "You then," said I, shaking him so warmly by the hand, that I wrung the rein out of his coat cuff, "are the gentleman whom I have so frequently contemplated, in connection with a high back chair with a red cushion, and a table with twisted legs." "I am that model," he rejoined moodily, "and I wish I was anything else." "Say not so," I returned. "I have seen you in the society of many beautiful young women," as in truth I had, and always, I now remember, in the act of making the most of his legs. "No doubt," said he. "And you've seen me along with horses of flowers, and any number of table kivers, and antique cabinets, and various gammon." "Sir?" said one. "And various gammon," he repeated, in a louder voice. "You might have seen me in armor too, if you had looked sharp. Blessed if I hadn't stood in half the suits of armor as ever came out of Pratt's shop, and sat, for weeks together, eating nothing, out of half the gold and silver dishes as has ever been lent for the purpose out of Storses, and Mortimerses, or Gerritses, and Davenports's seizes." Excited, as it appeared, by a sense of injury, I thought he would never have found an end for the last word. But, at length it rolled sullenly away with the thunder. "Pardon me," said I, "you are a well-favored, well-made man, and yet forgive me I find, on examining my mind, that I associate you with, that my recollection indistinctly makes you, in short excuse me, a kind of powerful monster." "It would be a wonder if it didn't," he said. "Do you know what my points are?" "No," said one. "My throat and my legs," said he. "When I don't set for a head, I mostly sets for a throat and a pair of legs. Now, granted you was a painter, and was to work at my throat for a week together, I suppose you'd see a lot of lumps and bumps there, that would never be there at all, if you looked at me, complete, instead of only my throat. Wouldn't you?" "Probably," said I, surveying him. "Why, it stands to reason," said the model. "Work another week at my legs, and it'll be the same thing. You'll make 'em out as knotty and as knobby, at last, as if they was the trunks of two old trees. Then, take and stick my legs and throat onto another man's body, and you'll make a reglar monster. And that's the way the public gets their reglar monsters, every first Monday in May, when the Royal Academy exhibition opens." "You are a critic," said I, with an air of deference. "I'm in an uncommon ill humor, if that's it," rejoined the model, with great indignation. "As if it weren't bad enough for a bob a hour, for a man to be mixing himself up with that there jolly old furniter, that one 'ud think the public know it the worry nails in by this time, or to be putting on greasy old hats and cloaks, and playing tambourines in the Bay o' Naples, with Vesuvius a-smoking according to pattern in the background, and the wines a bearing wonderful in the middle distance, or to be unpolitely kicking up his legs among a lot o' gals, with no reason whatever in his mind, but to show 'em, as if this weren't bad enough, I'm to go, and be thrown out of employment too. Apostrophe apostrophe, surely no. Apostrophe apostrophe said one. Surely yes, apostrophe said the indignant model. But I'll grow one. Apostrophe, the gloomy and threatening manner in which he muttered the last words, can never be effaced from my remembrance. My blood ran cold. I asked of myself, what was it, that this desperate being, was resolved to grow? My breast made no response. I ventured to implore him to explain his meaning. With a scornful laugh, he uttered this dark prophecy. I'll grow one. And, mark my words, it shall haunt you. Apostrophe, we parted in the storm, after I had forced half a crown on his acceptance, with a trembling hand. I conclude that something supernatural happened to the steamboat, as it bore his reeking figure down the river, but it never got into the papers. 2 years elapsed, during which I followed my profession without any vicissitudes, never holding so much as a motion, of course. At the expiration of that period, I found myself making my way home to the temple, one night, in precisely such another storm of thunder and lightning as that by which I had been overtaken on board the steamboat, except that this storm, bursting over the town at midnight, was rendered much more awful by the darkness and the hour. As I turned into my court, I really thought a thunderbolt would fall, and plow the pavement up. Every brick and stone in the place seemed to have an echo of its own for the thunder. The waterspouts were overcharged, and the rain came tearing down from the housetops, as if they had been mountaintops. Mrs. Parkins, my laundress wife of Parkins the porter, then newly dead of a dropsy, had particular instructions to place a bedroom candle and a match under the staircase lamp on my landing, in order that I might light my candle there whenever I came home. Mrs. Parkins invariably disregarding all instructions, they were never. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.